Drive. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. Court's ready to begin. Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. It's my pleasure to appear before the court this morning on behalf of plaintiff below appellant Edward T. McGowan. And Mr. McGowan is with us in the courtroom this morning. On this appeal, we urge that this court reverse the Delaware Court of Chancery's summary judgment ruling in favor of defendants and that it remand the case for trial of Mr. McGowan's breach of fiduciary duty and aiding and abetting claims. Those are counts 1 through 4 of his amended complaint. The issue is whether the Court of Chancery committed an error of law in granting the defendant's summary judgment, in deferring, as a matter of law, to the director defendant's decision to sell Empress's key assets for millions less than they were worth. This court's standard of and scope of review is de novo. To the argument, submit that there are 4 fundamental starting points. First, the Delaware courts will generally accord directors' decisions deference under the business judgment rule. They will not second-guess those decisions, provided those decisions are free from self-interest, are made with due care, and in good faith. Second, there are circumstances, however, when a court must take a more direct and active role in overseeing the decisions of and actions taken by directors, especially given the responsibility of directors to continue to discharge their fiduciary duties as circumstances change. One of those instances requiring exacting scrutiny is when a plaintiff establishes facts rebutting the presumption of the business judgment rule and shifts to the defendants the burden to establish at trial the entire fairness of the transaction, fair process, and fair price. Another instance requiring enhanced scrutiny is when, as a result of the transaction, there will be no tomorrow for the shareholders. There, the directors have the burden under Revlon to show that they were adequately informed and acted reasonably. It was this question, the applicable standard of review of the director defendant's decision, what former Chief Justice Veazey has described as the defining tension, that was before the Court of Chancery in this case. In this case, it was all about the defendant's motivations. And of critical importance, it was this question which the court addressed on a summary judgment motion without the benefit of trial. Then Justice Walsh, writing for this court in the Merrill case in 1992, observed that this court's review of a decision granting summary judgment is unqualified. In the court's words, since that determination is made on a paper record, we are free to draw our own inferences as to the legal significance of such evidence. And 10 years later, Justice Walsh, writing for the court in the Telkson versus Meyerson case, encapsulated the proper approach on summary judgment. Again, in the court's words, in evaluating the record on a motion for summary judgment, the trial judge is not permitted to weigh the evidence or resolve conflicts presented by the pretrial discovery. The test is not whether the judge considering summary judgment is skeptical that plaintiff will prevail, but whether the evidence, viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, presents any issues of material fact. The trier of fact may weigh the evidence and resolve disputes only after hearing all the evidence, including live witness testimony. And cross motions for summary judgment are not the procedural equivalent of a stipulation for decision on a paper record. Justice Holland, have I... What then did the Court of Chancery do here? As we've said in our briefs, the Court of Chancery's opinion reads respectfully like the post-trial decision that it isn't. Before the court were cross motions for summary judgment and a paper record, the same record that's now before this court. The record, as the court knows, included deal documents, board minutes, correspondence, copious handwritten notes from defendant Farrow, and deposition transcripts. After oral argument and without hearing from a single live witness, the court issued its 53-page ruling, concluding as a matter of law, the director defendant's decision to sell the core assets of the company for what Mr. McGowan claims was $242 million too little was conclusively protected by the business judgment rule. Thus, the court concluded as a matter of law that Mr. McGowan had not made a sufficient record showing to even raise a genuine issue as to whether the director defendants had breached one or more of their fiduciary duties, triggering entire fairness review. And the court concluded as a matter of law that the director defendants had carried their burden to satisfy Revlon enhanced scrutiny, that they had been adequately informed and had acted reasonably in granting the extension. How did the court reach its conclusions? Three ways, we submit. First, by not viewing the record in the light most favorable to Mr. McGowan, the non-movement. Second, by artificially heightening the summary judgment standard that he would face. And finally, by misconstruing or entirely disregarding key parts of the record before the court. First, failure to view the record in the light most favorable to Mr. McGowan. The court repeatedly accepted the defendant's characterization of disputed facts without giving itself the opportunity to evaluate credibility. For example, most notably, the court accepted in their entirety the so-called 16 good faith reasons proffered by defendants in the briefing below, when those reasons were not reflected in the contemporaneous notes and other contemporaneous documents in the record. The court accepted the defendant's characterization of the horseshoe transaction as a so-called bird in the hand and the risky nature of that transaction, not going forward with it. Particularly ironic, given the show-stopping nature of the lockup provisions in the merger agreement and the fact that the court, in the opinion, quoted from defendant McHenry, who later tried to buy back the Joliet Casino. The court accepted the benign nature of Farrell and Canfora negotiating the terms of the second extension. But unbeknownst to McGowan, those two men and others were planning the formation and funding of Empress Financial and the pursuit of Empress Entertainment's opportunities through Financial. Witness Farrell's October 24, 1998 diary entry, to which the Court of Chancery makes no reference whatsoever. Goal, 1, close, 2, money, 3, Newco. And notably, Farrell's ownership percentage in Empress Financial would quadruple, and Canfora's would go from 0 to 14.3%. Of course, Mr. McGowan's would go from 18.76% to 0. Witness General Counsel Hansen's memo of May 12, 1999, which summarized the self-described game plan office conference with Farrell, Canfora, and outside counsel. The memo said, Pete Farrell needs to talk to the five guys, then the seven guys. And in the same memo, also ignored by the court and from, by the way, Horseshoes production, not the defendants, this is what it said, discussion points. Do we buy McHenry out first, and or do we sell Hammond first? Map out the pros and cons. The court chancellor also accepted the defendant's view that the 6x EBITDA multiple was not a reliable way to measure the increased value of the assets by the time of the second extension. But the record of contemporaneous documents is replete with references to the 6x multiple. For example, again, General Counsel Hansen's May 4, 1999 memo to the CFO, Costello. Here's what it said. We are tracking $115 million EBITDA. Therefore, the company is worth $80 million more than on September 2, 1998. Date the merger agreement was signed.
Let me interrupt for a second here. I'm sure there could be 100 points in the record that the court didn't mention, and that if viewed in the light most favorable to your client could suggest, for example, that the defendants clearly were anticipating starting up again without your client. As I understand the court's decision, however, the court said, yeah, okay, that's what they had in mind. That's not actionable in and of itself. So if there were notes and minutes and other pieces of evidence that all suggest what the defendants were up to, they could be totally accepted and still don't change the result, do they?
Well, it begs the question, Your Honor, as to what the proper approach on a summary judgment motion, such as was before the Court of Chancery and is now before this court. I'd submit that they cannot be, and certainly should not be, totally accepted without an examination of those witnesses. In particular, the Court of Chancery, in this instance, just bought wholesale these 16 so-called good faith reasons I was mentioning a moment ago. Those reasons were based on post-litigation deposition testimony. And when the record before the Court of Chancery and the record before this Court is examined, those reasons aren't reflected in the contemporaneous notes, these copious Faro notes, minutes that Mr. McGowan had to sue to get because they were concealed from him. And so the heart of our position is that the court could not fairly evaluate the case before it and erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment based on the records that was before it.
Well, but see, that's what I'm trying to deal with. If there's all kinds of record evidence from which you could infer that the defendants had their own agenda, that they were trying to get rid of your client and move on with lucrative transactions in the future, that still doesn't give rise to any wrongdoing with respect to granting the extension, does it?
It does. It does indeed, because the defendants were serving their own interests in doing so. The defendants did everything they could to push this deal to closing on December 1, 1999, so that they could then pursue their own interests without McGowan. And even before that closing, they formed the new entity, Empress Financial. They voted down, and then 9 days later pursued a significant opportunity, the Flamingo Hilton opportunity, without McGowan. All of this kept from McGowan. And what Vice Chancellor Parsons concluded was that there was a conflict, that the director defendants had a conflict in what they were approaching in considering the Second Amendment. But he assumed that certain conduct on their part constituted bad faith, but he concluded that that bad faith conduct did not relate sufficiently, in his view, to the granting of the extension, and so the completion of the sale to Horseshoe. Our position is that he committed an error of law in concluding that.
Are you contending that Elan, if that's how it's pronounced, versus Consolidated Oil Company, 1929 case is not good law, or we should overrule that?
No. I believe, Your Honor, that what I'm suggesting is not, or should not, be at all controversial. The concept is that an interested group of directors cannot, without presenting an opportunity to the full board of directors, which did not happen here, cannot just go through the motions of voting down an opportunity and then turn around and pursue it themselves. Moreover, the record is replete with references to the early plan on the part of Faro and the others to set up this new entity, to exclude McGowan. There's a long history, and I know you've seen it in the briefs, a long history of frustration with McGowan and McHenry, with the supermajority vote, with unequal ownership percentages. Every step of the way, every effort was made by the director defendants to keep McGowan in the dark with respect to the second extension, to pave the way for the formation, the funding, and the operation of this new entity, Empress Financial. That propelled these director defendants to leave more than $240 million on the table. Our friends in their brief have suggested, tried to put the word in our mouths, irrational, that we've characterized the director defendants as being irrational in acting in the way they did. We have never offered such characterization. In fact, we believe, from what we can tell, it was coldly rational what Faro and the others intended to do and the scheme that they pursued. And to the detriment of Ed McGowan, again, an 18.76% shareholder. We submit that the continuum of bad faith conduct, actions on the part of the director defendants, at a minimum, establishes an issue as to whether or not these directors were serving their own interests in rushing this deal to closing, in not seeking removal of some of the deal protection devices, not insisting on insertion of a fiduciary out, but
Well, can I interrupt again? Doesn't this really boil down to, and I don't mean to be oversimplifying something that's not that simple, but doesn't it boil down to the fact that the defendants had a significant amount of their own money at stake in terms of whether to grant that extension or not, and that the amount of their own investment so far outweighed whatever they could have gotten, even, you know, assuming your scenario, that the court said there's nothing here from which I can reach a reasonable inference that there was any wrongdoing on their part. They were acting in what they believed would give them the best deal, and that was the most important thing.
The court did conclude that, Your Honor. In fact, even referred to profits of Empress Financial as speculative and so forth. And we submit that that's just simply belied by the record. Mr. Farrell and the other director defendants spent a tremendous amount of time and energy focusing on the opportunities that Empress Financial would pursue.
Okay, but what you're saying is that they left $230 million on the table, right?
More like $240.
Okay,
but yes.
Whatever. And most of that would have gone to them as opposed to your client. It's not as if there was $240 million left on the table and your client was getting 90% of that and they were going to get 10%.
Correct.
It was more flipped the other way.
That's true in the aggregate.
So as a matter of common sense, why would they have done that? Just because they don't like your client?
Well, first of all, they don't like my client.
I'm with you.
Right, but second, no, they had very real economic reasons. They secretly set up a revenue stream coming from the escrow that would be established post-liquidation and from the two remaining assets of the company so that these so-called management fees would be paid to Empress Financial, very substantial. And then they had high hopes, and it's reflected in the minutes before the court and Farrow's notes and elsewhere, high hopes in pursuing these various opportunities. Submit that McHenry's effort to buy the Empress Joliet casino with Costello and Hansen involved about a year after this closing for more than twice what that casino was valued in the Horseshoe deal is very telling. They knew they were selling on the cheap. They relied on stale information from Merrill Lynch. They had put Merrill Lynch in an untenable position with the termination of their employment. Fairness opinion should have been requested, would have been free, wasn't requested. Very, very good reason. It wasn't a fair deal. These director defendants Mr. McGowan should have the opportunity, we submit a trial, to make a prima facie showing of breach of one of the fiduciary duties, triggering the entire fairness standard. These director defendants should have the obligation to carry their burden at trial, to establish entire fairness through fair process and fair price. We certainly believe there's no way they can do that. But what Mr. McGowan's looking for is his day in court. There was a misapplication of the summary judgment standard here. Your Honor, I'm going to stop here if I may and reserve what looks like a minute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. It's a pleasure to be here again. I will attempt to explain to the Court the three most important reasons demonstrating why the Court of Chancery's decision to grant summary judgment to the defendants was well-reasoned and correct. First, Mr. McGowan has plainly misconstrued the teachings of this Court regarding the applicable standard for summary judgment. Justice Berger asked precisely the right question and got precisely the wrong answer to that. I will explain why, under the correct standard, we're entitled to summary judgment. As part of that explanation, I will address why no rational trier of fact could determine on this record that Mr. McGowan should prevail on his loyalty, good faith, or Revlon claims. Third, and briefly, I will explain why Mr. McGowan's acquiescence to the transaction bars all of his claims. I've been involved in this litigation for more than 4 years. I attended all but one of the depositions. I would urge the court to consider carefully the accuracy of what you've been told about the state of the factual record in this case. There are a number of facts that are plainly undisputed, which are material to this case. First, Dentist Berger is absolutely correct in pointing out that the director's own money was at stake. Every one of my clients had millions of dollars of his own money riding on this decision. It was a minimum $7 million under Mr. McGowan's theory to Pete Farrell, the alleged ringleader, and more than $40 million to several of my clients. We've heard no explanation so far as to how or why these defendants would have walked away from that amount of money to pursue the speculative inverse financial opportunity. There's also been no reference to the fact that this is a third-party transaction. This isn't a self-dealing deal. My clients got nothing that wasn't shared equally with Mr. McGowan. None of my clients were beholden to Horseshoe, and Mr. McGowan has admitted in his deposition that my clients secured, in conjunction with a second extension, as much as they could get from Horseshoe.
Let me stop you there, because if I understand it correctly, the trial court said, as you've just suggested, no rational person, no rational director would have cut off his nose to spite his face. There was so much of their own money involved that the court can take comfort in that and therefore find that there was no wrongdoing here. Having said that, let's assume for a moment that your clients, although they stood to lose what I would consider to be an enormous sum of money, have a different perspective on things. And from their perspective, they consider themselves better off blowing this deal or, you know, taking it at less than a fair price and less than what they could get in order to get this over with, get McGowan out of there, and then go make five times as much money back in the next year or two with post-dissolution transactions that they would be free of the thorn in their side. Now, it may not be the way I would approach a decision like that. I might be more cautious and want to take the best deal I could get right now and not be thinking about how much money I could make a year from now. But how do we know that the directors, the defendants here, weren't operating in that fashion, which would arguably state a claim?
This gets to the heart of what the correct standard is on summary judgment. Mr. McGowan's theory relies heavily on the claim that the Court of Chancery misapplied the summary judgment standard because it weighed or evaluated the evidence. Mr. McGowan asserts that if there is any evidence that could lead could lend any support to his claims, the summary judgment is inappropriate. That is simply the wrong standard. This court clarified in Cerberus that the question is whether any rational trier of fact could find on the record presented to the Court of Chancery, viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, that the plaintiff had proven the elements of his prima facie case. So there are two standards that can't be satisfied in conjunction with this argument. First, he's got to convince a rational person sitting on the Delaware Supreme Court that they would have walked away from a minimum of $7 and more than $40 million to pursue a speculative opportunity. And secondly, he has to prove it at the summary judgment stage by pointing to tangible evidence to that effect. We submit that no justice of the Supreme Court of Delaware could possibly conclude that somebody is going to walk away from $7 to $40 million in order to pursue the speculative opportunity represented by Empress Financial. They keep harping on the fact that we're pursuing the Kansas City Flamingo Hilton. That was an opportunity which my clients testify would have been made available to Mr. McGowan. That was an opportunity which was not successful. That is a corporate opportunity claim which is not before this court on appeal. That was part of an investment club, Empress Financial, which my client set up. We hear that supposedly a substantial amount of money was being funded at Empress Financial through Empress Entertainment Assets. The reality is it was $1 million. and it was done on an arm's length basis at the cost for comparable services from third parties. Amherst Financial is simply an investment club by my clients to pursue new business opportunities following the dissolution of Empress Entertainment. My clients, Justice Harlan recognized, had every right to walk away from this venture. Elan has been settled law. What Mr. McGowan confuses is what my clients wanted to do after Empress Entertainment and what they did in granting the second extension. In our view, we asked the court to go back and look at the precedents which have required plaintiffs on summary judgment motions and breach of fiduciary duty cases to overcome the presumption of the business judgment rule by demonstrating facts that would lead a rational trier of fact to find in the plaintiff's favor. On these facts, you have to suspend disbelief, suspend human nature, walk away from everything you know about the motivations of people in order to think that my clients may have pursued these opportunities solely out of spite for Mr. McGowan. That's not what happened here. My clients had multiple good faith reasons. The record is documented that at least 6 of our 16 reasons were in writing at the time of the decision to pursue the second extension. There's no dispute we secured, in my view, at least $30 million of additional consideration for the second extension.
Why weren't the other 10 in writing?
My clients, unlike the ordinary situation, are the owners and operators of the business. They were there day in, day out. They understood exactly what was going on. And the sorts of corporate formalities you might expect to see in a Fortune 500 company do not exist when you're dealing with a company where you have the owners of a company involved in the operation, involved in the sale process, and who stood, as Justice Berger has recognized, to reap 90% of the benefits of the transaction. These people lived with this business. They knew what amount of money was at stake. They knew no other bidders had come up in the year after the deal had been announced. These people had everything on the line, and in order to accept Mr. McGowan's theory, you have to believe that they threw it all away, left $240 million on the table to pursue an investment club where they were going to have to make further capital contributions to pursue speculative, unknown ventures with no guarantee of success. We submit no rational trier of fact could conclude on the basis of this evidence that that's what they intended to do, and there's no tangible evidence to that effect. My clients have all been deposed. What is a trial going to give us at this stage of the game? An opportunity to redepose my clients, to cross-examine them on the very issues they've already been deposed about? It's not a credibility issue here. The question is whether, on summary judgment, you, as rational finders of fact, could conclude that there is some tangible evidence here that requires Mr. McGowan's claims to go to trial. The substantive evidentiary standard simply has to be considered here. Mr. McGowan never acknowledges that the trial court is required, in the words of this court in Cerberus, to take the substantive evidentiary standard into consideration when ruling on a summary judgment motion. Thus, it's Mr. McGowan's obligation to make out a prima facie case and to point to tangible facts which would allow you rationally to conclude that we had this irrational idea to leave $240 million on the table to pursue speculative business ventures. In order to avoid summary judgment, Mr. McGowan has to point to tangible evidence in the record that could lead a rational trier of fact to conclude that he has proven that the business judgment rule presumptions are inapplicable here and that the second extension was a breach of fiduciary duty. We don't think he can do it, and we submit that the correct application of the legal standard for summary judgment is not to show that there is some evidence for some crazy theory that might lead somebody somehow to find in his favor. That's not the test articulated in Cerberus, in Burkhart, or any of the other Supreme Court decisions. The test here is whether Mr. McGowan can prevail at trial and whether he's presented evidence on the summary judgment sufficient to allow a rational trier of fact to find in his favor. That does not exist. The three substantive claims that are raised in this case relate to purported conflicts of interest or a breach of the duty of loyalty, a bad faith decision in granting the second extension, and a purported failure to address Revlon standards. Let me briefly address each of those arguments. First, the Farrell and Campora employment agreements are a pure red herring. They establish no conflict of interest. Mr. McGowan voted in favor of those agreements because he knew they were intended to satisfy the regulators, that there was competent management at the casinos, and to allow Horseshoe to raise the financing for the deal. Mr. McGowan also acknowledged in his deposition that Farrell and Campora secured as much consideration from Horseshoe as possible in negotiating the second extension. These guys had no conflict of interest. We keep hearing about Empress Financial. What is the scale of Empress Financial when compared to $240 million? It was an investment club with nothing tangible, with $1 million of operations. Mr. McGowan never attaches a particular financial interest to the corporate opportunities allegedly associated with Empress Financial. That is enough under this court's precedence to demonstrate that my clients had no conflict of interest. This court repeatedly has required plaintiffs to demonstrate the financial materiality of an interest in order to disqualify a director from exercising independent judgment. There is absolutely zero evidence in this record of a financially irrational attachment by any of the Empress directors to Empress Financial. The idea that my clients deliberately, and not through gross negligence or ordinary negligence, but deliberately and without regard to the financial consequences, gave up tens of millions of dollars apiece to start an organization like Empress Financial is simply ludicrous. It requires you to walk away from human nature to believe that these guys would leave $7 to $40 million on the table to go pursue new opportunities which were not tangible, which they had no prospect of guaranteed success on. The Empress Financial opportunities never came to fruition. The undisputed testimony is that Mr. McGowan would have been included in the Flamingo Hilton deal, and the Flamingo Hilton deal was in fact something that came up primarily after the second extension. The decision to abandon the corporate opportunity at the corporate level came in September after the decision had been made in July. It's clearly a post-sale, post-extension decision. The heart of this case from Mr. McGowan's perspective is focused on the bad faith claim. His theory depends entirely on the hypothesis that my clients had improper and illicit motives in making what appears on its face, members of this court have recognized to be a perfectly rational business decision. My clients extended only for 60 days in exchange for $30 million of additional consideration, an opportunity to close the only deal on the table. The second decision, extension decision, was duly authorized. It wasn't wasteful. It wasn't irrational. And Mr. McGowan received equal proceeds with my clients. So the standard here in evaluating whether summary judgment is appropriate on the bad faith claim is whether Mr. McGowan has evidence that would allow you as the rational finder of fact to conclude that the decision was so far beyond the bounds of reasonable judgment that it seems essentially inexplicable on any ground other than bad faith. The oldest articulation of bad faith, which was set forth in the J.P. Stevens decision. The evidentiary standard relevant to this decision was articulated by this court in Gilbert versus El Paso. In order for Mr. McGowan to overcome our summary judgment motion on the bad faith claim, he has to point to credible and direct evidence to support essential allegations of his theory. He has to point to something tangible which indicates that my clients had culpable intent, and he has to have something more than innuendo to justify an inference of wrongful intent. Mr. McGowan's theories make no sense. There is no credible and direct evidence, nothing tangible, nothing beyond unsupported allegations to suggest that my clients would have walked away knowingly, deliberately from $240 million in order to pursue Empress Financial. The purported conspiracy of silence Mr. McGowan refers to is a red herring. He was given notice for all the board meetings. He had the opportunity to participate. He chose not to dial in, admittedly under difficult personal circumstances, but that doesn't give him a right to come back here and argue that he was deliberately excluded. There is no evidence to that effect. The testimony was that he spoke with Mr. McHenry, my client, on a daily basis in July before the second extension decision. He chose not to participate in that meeting. The game plan memorandum is the ultimate red herring in this case. The language that they rely upon comes beneath the caption pointing to the specific reasons and the steps that my clients were going to take in order to secure additional consideration from Horseshoe. It has nothing to do whatsoever when you look at the document to excluding Mr. McGowan from anything. Ultimately, Mr. McGowan's mudslinging about our purported malign intent to him or our ulterior motivations is beside the point. Justice Berger asked the question correctly. Does any of this have to do with the rational decision that was made on July 15th to approve the second extension? The answer is clearly no. My clients ultimately secured a written consent for the second extension, which cured the procedural issues that were raised. The 220 action involved conduct by the company's general counsel that occurred at a later point in time and has nothing to do with the second extension. The brief sets forth very clearly the multiple justifications we had. Because no rational trier of fact could conclude on this record that my clients acted in bad faith in approving the second extension, we're entitled to summary judgment. The Revlon claim was the third and final hurdle laid in our path, there are multiple reasons why the Revlon claim doesn't matter. First, the Revlon standard simply should not apply in this context. This is not a case where, for agency reasons related to the relationship or the divergence of relationships between directors and stockholders, that we need a heightened standard of judicial review. My clients were the stockholders, they were the directors, they were intimately involved. So the sorts of policy reasons based on agency theory that lead to the Revlon doctrine don't make sense in a privately held company context. Secondly, this wasn't an original sale decision. Revlon should apply to the initial decision to sell the company where there is justifiable concern for agency reasons about whether the right decision has been made. In this case, my clients faced a binary decision, either take this deal or have no deal. This isn't a situation where we're worrying about deal protection devices or disfavoring bidders. My clients were operating at arm's length with the only bidder who had surfaced, who had committed financing, and was willing to pay my clients more than $609 million and had agreed to two extensions and given my clients still additional consideration. Since there is no concern about divergence of interest between directors and stockholders, we submit that Revlon shouldn't apply. Even if it does apply, the 102b7 provision in the charter bars any due care claims. So what does that leave Mr. McGowan to do? He's got to show that the Revlon-related conduct falls outside the scope of the 102b7 exculpation. That necessarily means that he's got to show that my clients acted in bad faith or they acted with disloyalty in order to get around 102b7. So it's a circular argument. I've already explained why there was no disloyal conduct, or at least no rational trier of fact could find that there was disloyal or bad faith conduct. If you apply the standards correctly, McGowan has to show a loyalty violation or a bad faith claim to get outside the exculpatory clause. We don't think he can do it. There are multiple reasons showing that this decision to grant the second extension was reasonable. No rational trier of fact has concluded that in exchange for a 60-day extension for an additional $30 million, that the decision was so unreasonable as to fall outside the scope of business judgment. The deal protection measures were valid. Mr. McGowan voted for them. They were ratified by all the stockholders, not once but twice. There's no evidence that any third-party bid was impeded. Anybody who wanted to buy this company had access to the Horseshoe public filings and could have whispered at Merrill Lynch's ear or my client's ear that they were interested in topping the Horseshoe bid. Everybody knew that Horseshoe was having regulatory problems, and the fact of the matter was, on July 15th, my clients had to either take the bird in the hand or assume all of the risks, which we detailed in our briefs, about losing the prospects of the only game in town, which was fully financed, and at that time was the highest price that was ever going to be paid for riverboat casinos. We didn't need another fairness opinion precisely because this was a closely held company. It would have cost us $500,000, which would have been at risk if the deal didn't close. My clients were also the stockholders. They knew what was going on here. They didn't need anything else. Because it was logical for my clients to grant a 60-day extension in exchange for $30 million, there is no Revlon claim which can fall outside the scope of the 102b7 protection. Finally, we get to Mr. McGowan's acquiescence in all of this. Mr. McGowan is in this courtroom today having pocketed $82 million from this transaction. At the time he did so, he fully knew that the second extension had been granted. He knew the terms of the second extension. He even voted at the November 29 board meeting for the extraordinary dividend that gave him the $82 million. All of his claims about the EBITDA and increased value were known. In fact, his lawyer who was sitting in this courtroom had been writing letters to us about that. He knew that we were planning on going into business without him. Mr. McGowan simply knew all of the material facts regarding the second extension, and he knowingly acquiesced when he accepted his $83 million check. The factors cited in the brief regarding his supposed lack of knowledge are irrelevant. He didn't know about Empress Financial. That's not true. There's the letters that he relies upon where Farrell told him he wouldn't be included in any new business. Kansas City Flamingo Hilton opportunities got nothing to do with the second extension, as Justice Berger intimated. The 220 action came later in time and is irrelevant, and our bad motives are simply a red herring. He took $83 million, knowing full well what the deal was. That's acquiescence, and we urge that alternative ground to dismiss this complaint. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very briefly, because most of what Mr. Abrams has said we responded to in our reply brief, but he has the standard for summary judgment wrong. He made mention we have to show enough to prevail below. That's just simply not the case. And the standard I was articulating followed, as was later in time, than Cerberus. Second, he trivializes or perhaps tries to enshroud his clients as ingenues, this investment club. They were sophisticated people represented by a top-class law firm, D'Ancona & Flom, in connection with the transaction. Acquiescence, no acquiescence on McGowan's part. If the price was wrong and the process was unfair, the price was wrong and the process was unfair. And finally, he asked, what do you want, an opportunity to cross-examine in court? Yes, we want an opportunity to cross-examine in court. The standard is subjective, bad faith, not objective, as the court below concluded. The court's decision should be reversed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Barris. The court will take this matter under advisement and we will adjourn.
Please draw my... Hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.